we're going to get started so we take advantage of our time. We're glad you're here and honored to have you in with us this particular period. If you didn't get a handout on the way in, we tried to scatter a few of them around the room, but it looks like this. It's these green sheets. So if you have an extra one or one close by, just grab that, and that'll help you as you follow along. You can take notes on that as you scroll through. First of all, my name is Robert Oglesby. I'm a professor here at ACU and work in the Youth and Family Department. I've been here 16 years as the professor of youth ministry at this place, but prior to that, I did about 18 years at two different churches, one called the Western Hills Church in Temple, Texas, and then 15 years at the Southern Hills Church here in Abilene. So I have a background with a foot in both worlds. I still am a part-time family minister at the Southern Hills Church, and then the rest of my job here at ACU covers my time. And my partner here in crime today is David Sessions, who's the youth minister of the Highland Church of Christ, and hasn't been here for like a year.
December.
Yep. Coming up. So he knows nothing about youth ministry at all.
True. True.
He actually was at the Woodmont Church of Christ up in Nashville before that, so he's got a lot, and it's been a pleasure to work with this young man. I'm a little bit older than he is, just a year or two older than he is, but we're going to share today some contemporary issues and some things that I think are really significant to think about in the near future. So, David.
All right. Thanks for being here. I'm humbled to be here, and I think best about things when I can like put them in context. So some of you probably already know how we got here, so to speak, with youth ministry, but let's just have a quick run through of how youth ministry came to be, okay? So there was a thing that you've probably heard of called World War II. Before World War II, there does not exist an adolescent class of people in the United States. Not really. I mean, there were teenagers. They probably didn't call them teenagers. But in the United States, there was not a group of people who were in their educational years and had disposable time and income. Didn't happen. So World War II happens, and there's this new demographic because people, GIs, came back and they moved to the suburbs, and they had white-collar jobs, and they weren't working on family farms anymore, and they were sending their children to be exclusively students. And these students, when they weren't at school, sometimes had jobs, sometimes didn't, but they had disposable income. And so for the first time ever, you start seeing things in the late 50s, early 60s directed at youth culture. All right? Advertisers realize that there was a new group of people that had money to spend, and so they start selling to them. Around the same time, there's this emergence of parachurch ministries. So Young Life, Youth for Christ, Jim Rayburn, anyone know who that is up there? It's Billy Graham back in his younger days. He was with the Youth for Christ, and Jim Rayburn started this group called Young Life. Young Life's a really great thing, I think, part of my faith story. But there are these parachurch organizations because they've realized that maybe adolescents, as they are now existing in the United States, aren't getting their spiritual needs met at churches. Maybe there's just some age-appropriate material lacking. And so they start. And then churches realize, hey, we're kind of letting these parachurch organizations do for us what we think we maybe should be doing for our own youth. And so we start hiring youth ministers, ministers especially for teenagers. And this is really where we start seeing the emergence of what we call youth ministry. And youth ministers. We start putting money towards that from churches, and we start going on mission trips, and we start having youth-specific classes, and we start having youth-specific volunteers in our church, and youth ministry culture as we know it comes into fruition. In about 1988, a guy named Stuart Cummings Bond wrote an article that coined the phrase a one-eared Mickey Mouse. Has anyone heard about this phrase? All right, here's Mickey Mouse. There's his head. There's his one ear. Wait, that's not right, because it's a Venn diagram. They're only going to touch. All right, this is church, and this is youth ministry. And what started happening around the late 80s is we realize that we have been so successful in ministering to youth that we have ministered to them right out of the fabric and the knitting of our churches. And that they happen to be meeting under the same roof, and we are paying that guy or that gal over there to be the minister, but really it's a different church. And they don't know us, and we don't know them. And if you, is anyone at James K. Smith's 11 o'clock session in Cullum? He ripped us a new one, and he was right. He was right. We have commoditized our youth away from the ministry of the church, from uncles and aunts in faith, grandparents in faith, parents in faith. And if they're not volunteering in the youth ministry, our youth don't know them, and we are selling them short. And we have this emergence of the rise of the nuns, right? Not NUS, not Women in Habits, but culture of people who are not affiliated with any sort of religion at all in the United States. It's one of the fastest growing religious groups, even though they don't have a religion. And it's because, I think, in large part, because of a one-year Mickey Mouse. They graduated from high school. They looked for a ministry that looked like this in college, and maybe they found it, maybe they didn't. But because they have never practiced their faith inside of a multi-generational context, they are looking for a church that does not exist, and they think that the problem is with God. So this all leads us to one of my favorite people. Oh, wait, sorry. 2000s, churches begin identifying, oh, yeah, we've got a problem. Maybe we should start incorporating adults into our ministries and facilitating a faith formation with not only students, but their parents. Some people would say, like one of my heroes in youth ministry, Mike Iaconelli, wrote an article in 2003, youth ministry as an experiment has failed. If you know the name Mike Iaconelli, he is a hero in youth ministry circles. He did more for youth ministry as a serious profession than a lot of people. And he said in an article in 2003, youth ministry as an experiment has failed. Maybe more accurate to say youth ministry as we know it has failed. We need to rethink youth ministry. So that's where we are. If you are familiar with the writings of Chap Clark or the people over at the Fuller Youth Institute, we have been naming the problem for years. We've been naming the problem really, really well for about 3 years. The one-eared Mickey Mouse. The youth ministry that contributes to fleeing from faith in your mid-20s and 30s. My frustration is that sometimes we haven't been putting forth really clear practices and strategies for reversing this. So I think there are a lot of contemporary issues in youth ministry. And we have 45 minutes to talk about all of them. But really, I think there's one. And I think it's this. I think that youth ministry, by and large, has been, again, James K. Smith hit the nail on the head, fueled from adult anxieties. And because of those anxieties, we have been making poorer and poorer decisions that have not contributed to the faith formation of teenagers, but have been about making us feel better. Okay, there's a lot going on here. So what is youth ministry? Let's talk about some of those anxieties. What is youth ministry? If you talk to a parent, they might say it's something like behavior modification. What do you want your child to get out of youth ministry? I really want them to act better. I want them to know the Ten Commandments. I want them to be a good person. Those are good things. But do you see how an anxiety-fueled decision might lead that down a negative path? If we are first and foremost about behavior modification, that's not good news. That is not the good news of Jesus. I think we get there, but that's not how Jesus ever started. Leaders, like myself, we are really guilty about this. Leaders' anxiety is, are there rears in the seats? Because we're going to have to answer to somebody who writes a check for us quarterly, yearly, bi-yearly, and they're going to want to know what numbers are like. And so our anxiety, people like me's anxiety, is are we attracting people? Are we putting their rears in seats? It's not a bad thing for teenagers to be coming. It's not a bad thing for a youth room to be full. But if all I ever care about is you, is that you're here, that's not good news.
Right.
That's not faith formation. And what I see a lot happening in youth ministry right now is man, we attracted so many students. Did you follow up? Did you listen to them at all? Do you know what they're good at? Do you know what they're talking about? I don't think that's for faith formation to have rears and seats. I think, so other types of leaders, so maybe like elders or deacons or someone, they might be, or volunteers, they might be wondering about, are we giving them the right answers? Okay, so I've got huddle leaders right now, and one of the ways I'm recruiting them, to start with our ninth grade, one of their anxieties over and over again is like, I don't know how I'm going to be when they ask me a hard question. I'm not like a biblical scholar, so I don't know what I'm going to do if they ask me a hard question. Do you see the anxiety? We're afraid that if we don't have the finer points of theology nailed down, that we're going to somehow fail our students. So I don't think that youth ministry is primarily behavior modification. I really am pretty sure it's not rears and seats. And I don't think that primarily students need adults in their lives for answers. I think all of those things are good, but they all fall short of sharing the good news of Jesus Christ. So we're going to do a case study here. I've got a reader. I've got a habit I like, I want to invite you to, is that when God speaks to us, we stand out of respect. And then when I speak to you, you sit out of disrespect. But if you'll do this, if you'll stand, she's going to read to us from Matthew chapter 19, and we're going to take the rich young ruler as a case study.
Someone came to Jesus with this question: Teacher, what good deed must I do to have eternal life? Why ask me about what is good? Jesus replied, there's only one who is good. But to answer your question, if you want to receive eternal life, keep the commandments. Which ones? The man asked, and Jesus replied, you must not murder, you must not commit adultery, you must not steal, you must not testify falsely. Honor your father and mother, love your neighbor as yourself. I have obeyed all these commandments, the young man replied. What else must I do? Jesus told him, if you want to be perfect, go and sell all your possessions and give the money to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven, then come follow me. But when the young man heard this, he went away sad, for he had many possessions.
All right, the word of the Lord. Have a seat. The rich young ruler, the rich young man, he comes to Jesus and he's got a burning question. I think his question is, at the heart of it, I try to be so good and I have a hole in my heart. Why? Well, perhaps behavior modification isn't good news. Did you know that right now there is, in America, in this country, less children engaging in drug and alcohol abuse, less sex, less vulgarities than any generation before them since World War II? You wouldn't believe that, would you? Not from the portrayals that we have of teenagers on media. Certainly not. Our teenagers could teach us a pretty good lesson about pure behavior. They tend not to engage in it. Did you know that adults spend more, especially parents, spend more time today with their teenagers than any other period in American history since before World War II? It's quantifiable. So why is it that we're spending more time with our teenagers, that they behave better than ever before? And we still have, are you all familiar with Christian Smith's and Chapclock's research with the HURT and HURT 2.0? Okay, so what they found in this extensive research and study is that teenagers are more alone and more isolated and hurting more than ever before. Why? We got it right. We spend more time with them. We taught them how to choose against, to just say no to drugs, to wait till marriage, to cuss less. And they are like the rich young ruler coming to Jesus and saying, I've done all the things you told me to do, and I don't have life. Right? We know when he says eternal life, he doesn't just mean temporarily, like temporally, right? Just not just going forward. It doesn't end life. It also means expansive life, fullness of life now. I don't have it. Why? And so Jesus says, what do the commandments say? And he says, I've done all these things, right? And we also might substitute there that he participated in worship, right? He followed the law. The Hebrew law is to worship. His rear was in a seat from the very beginning. He was showing up to the devos and to the lock-ins and to the mission trips. He was there. He was there for all of it. And he says, why do I have this healing in my heart? Well, are they living right? It's not a gospel question. Not primarily. How many showed up? Not a gospel question. Not a discipleship question. And then he says, Jesus says to him, what I need you to do is follow me. What I need you to do is follow me. And we thought that this was about money and the evilness of money. Jesus never once tells anybody to worship him. What's his constant reoccurring invitation to people? Follow me. So James K. Smith says, you are what you love. Your repetitive habits, your liturgies will make you a different person. Richard Rohr says, we don't think our way into new behavior. We behave our way into new perspectives and new thoughts. They're both saying what Jesus said. Do you want to know how to fix the hole in your heart? You don't start with behavior modification. You don't start as an answering machine. You don't start by just showing up. You start with following, as Hebrews says, the full manifestation of God on earth. And that's it. If we want to give life to teenagers, if we want to see maybe perhaps the reversal of the rise of the nuns in the Western Hemisphere, maybe it's because we weren't taking the message of Jesus seriously. And that he never asks them to be followers. Sorry, he never asks them to be worshipers, primarily followers first. We believe that perhaps worship would come after following Jesus and a life lived towards the cross. But if they're not primarily followers, they will be succumbing to lesser gospels of behavior modification, showing up as if that were being a disciple, and looking to others and maybe perhaps becoming themselves an answering machine. So, sorry, I just completely passed over that slide. That would have helped my train of thought. What does Jesus think youth ministry is? It's not behavior modification. It's not worship. It's not simply answers. Jesus wants young people to follow him as he does what only he is capable of doing, guiding us towards death, rebirth, union with God, and life in the Spirit. That's the gospel. That's the gospel message. So, all right, that's a lot of theory. I went through it really, really fast. Let's give a working definition. Here's what I think a good definition of youth ministry is. I think churches are doing youth ministry well. Not individual youth ministers. Churches are doing youth ministry well when they are inviting teenagers to begin their life's journey with Jesus, train them to do it well, and extend grace and encouragement when it becomes difficult. We are not sequestering them into another room to make it really, really fun. We are bringing them into the fabric of our church so that they see us follow Jesus, that we invite them to be what Jesus invited the rich young ruler to be, a follower of Jesus primarily, first and foremost. And the church then behaves like the church for teenagers just because they happen to be human beings that are a different age. We do what we're always good at doing. We do what only the church can do. Encourage each other towards Christ. Be there for each other when it's difficult. And we look at each other and we say, you're good at this, the kingdom needs it. Will you bring it? So, practical application. I think this is what churches can actually do. I think that they should take the message of Jesus seriously. I don't think that's too much to ask. I think the gospel's still enough. I think whenever we're teaching teenagers, because I still think that there is age-appropriate education that needs to happen, right? I think that sometimes adults need their classes and teenagers need their classes. I think we need to be creative about ways of bringing them together. But when we teach teenagers, if it's the gospel, it's easy. If it's Paul, the Old Testament, I believe that all of the Bible teaches, leads us towards Jesus. Sometimes the Old Testament is telling us what world Jesus lived in and what texts were formative to him. Jesus quotes the Psalms and Isaiah more than anything else. I think it's really important that we talk to our teenagers about the Psalms and Isaiah, because they were like Jesus's Harry Potter, right? They really formed him, right? And so it would be good for us to know those texts. I think we teach towards Jesus. I think we have to have really, really hard conversations. And I think that those things happen separately sometimes. I have parents ask me more a lot, do you teach about LGBTQ issues? Well, not as regularly as maybe you hope, because Jesus didn't talk about it ever. Do you teach about pornography? No, I don't teach about pornography in this setting. Do we talk about it with teenagers? Yes. I don't think it's fair to a listener to have a really, really loaded conversation where I'm the only one talking. I don't think that's right. I think that to take the message of Jesus seriously means to be confident enough about it that they get to push back a little bit. And so I think that youth ministry needs to create environments where we are having really, really hard conversations with our teenagers, and they get to say what they think is true, and I get to say what I think is true, and we kind of just let it sit there. That's what a conversation is, right? I mean, if I were really to have a conversation with another person, if they were an adult, I wouldn't just be trying to prove them wrong. I would be listening empathetically, I hope. I think we need to be having these conversations with our teenagers. The next thing I think is really, really important is I think that they should just be a part of the church. I think we need to kill the one-eared Mickey Mouse. I mean, kill it. Is there times for age-appropriate discipleship? Yes, of course. But if you're only spending your time drawing teenagers to a place, if you're only concerned about putting rears in seats and they don't meet other people in your church and they're not formed by other people in your church, you are selling them short and, I believe, directly contributing to their long-term plans, I think. So what does this mean? I think that we should say, hey, what are you passionate about? What makes you come alive? Woodworking. Okay, great. I don't know how we're going to use that in our church right now, but we're going to find a place. Right now, we have students who are really, really excited about this bake sale that they just did. Okay, is flour and sugar and whatever it takes to make cookies, is that really important? Well, it was to them because it was a trip they had where they went to a low-income community development center in Fort Worth, and they realized they didn't have great child seats in their vans. And so our middle school girls said, well, we want to fix that, and that's not right. And so they had a big sale at our church, and they raised $400, and they bought, like, I don't know, a lot of child seats for this Fortress Ministry in Fort Worth. And look, that's something they could do. And it was part of the mission of our church. They were missionaries for our church that week, that summer. Find out what they're good at and use it for the mission of your church. Intergenerational discipleship. Intergenerational discipleship is not intergenerational fellowship. I have been a part of things where, I'll just tell you, it was a Valentine's Day banquet, and the old folks came, and we entertained them, and we served them, and it was like, it felt good, and it was really fun. But do you know what? That just drew the lines more boldly. Like, it was just even more obvious that they were old, and we were young, and we were serving them, right? We weren't receiving anything from them. They weren't giving anything to us. Sometimes intergenerational fellowship can make the lines feel even harder. But discipleship, treating each other as equals, Paul would talk about this as co-adoption. We're all adopted into Christ. No one has anything more above anybody else. I think that really means walking with each other in honesty and humility. And so my ministry has got this 5-to-1 ratio, okay? We'll talk about this a little bit more. 1 to 20 keeps us legal, all right? That's how we make sure no one gets sued. That's one adult for every 20 students. That's like the minimum. A while ago we said, what we really want to do is we don't just want to staff for legality, we want to staff for relationship, and so we're going for a 5-to-1, five students for every one adult. That's really going to be much more relational. Now I'm thinking about, and this is recent, making it a goal to be 1 to 5. That's one adult for every, one student for every 5 adults. What if youth ministry was not, how exciting can I make 200 teenagers about David Sessions? What if instead it was, how can I get this whole church to see themselves as co-disciples, intergenerational disciples with these teenagers, so that every student had 5 non-parental adults pouring into their lives, asking them how they're doing, waiting long enough to listen, asking what they're good at, finding a way to make that gift work towards our mission as a church. We're just starting it, and I don't know how it's going to go yet, but I feel pretty strongly about the 5-to-1 ratio. I think that's how we're going to kill the one-eared Mickey Mouse. I think that's how our students are going to be more brought into the fold and part of the church again. So that's what I've got. Robert's going to come up and give some more practical things about how we do this.
Thank you.
Setting the record straight?
Not at all. What David's talking about is right on target. And one of the things that I like about it is it's very clear what the mission is. It's to get them to the feet of Jesus. The rich young ruler, he had anticipated that conversation with Jesus to go very differently than it did. He thought he's going to get a pat on the back and you're doing things great. And man, you did the right side of the Ten Commandments really, really well. And then he says, if there's anything I lack. And if you notice in the text, it says, and Jesus looked at him and loved him and told him one of the hardest things he ever heard in his life. Go sell everything you got. Clarity. Extreme clarity. Jesus had a way of doing that. Stuff like, take, you know, deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow me. Now, that's a nice mission statement, isn't it? But you got to deny yourself first in order to take up that cross and to follow. Simple. Sometimes in church, we get a little bit confusing. We send what they call a mixed message. Let me show you a picture that might be a mixed message, possibly. If you can see, looks like a bunch of nuns from California, obviously. Very liberal, like, you know. When in reality, it's just simply some stools that they're sitting on that their legs are, just in case you can't see that very well. That's not really their legs, so don't get excited, anybody. Another one. Let me show you a picture. What do you see here in this picture? See an old lady?
Young lady.
Whoa, wait a minute. You're looking at the same picture here. You see a young lady over here, right? Do you see the old lady too? You got some of you're going, uh-huh. They're both in there. And we're looking at the same exact thing. And if you don't, you're all trying to figure out, okay, where is it exactly? I'll tell you later. I'll let you come look at it after class. I don't want to take up time to show all that. But bottom line is, we got some generations looking at spirituality, and we're seeing them a little differently. That's why we're having a hard time. But we're looking for clarity. Can we get on the same page? Can we understand? An older generation's spirituality may look very differently. They're there every single time. They give lots and lots of money to the church. And yet, we have a younger generation, well, they don't give as much money, but boy, they give their lives sometimes. They step in big time. And they say, there's some folks down in Houston need some help because of this flood. And they hop in the van, and they're ready to roll. And you may be going, well, I'm really busy. Just looks differently because Jesus called them to different things in different ways. And it's the same picture we're looking for. But I'm going to tell you some harder stuff, and I hope you'll understand. I love the church. I love the leaders of the church, but I want to tell you some hard things that I think David's taking us to ask some of these questions. That is this. First question. Is youth ministry about protection, or is it about taking a risk? Is Christianity a safe endeavor to jump into? Thank you for the mood music there. Brings me right to my conclusion. We've got a lot of folks that are basically out to protect the kids, the students in the church. They don't want to take a risk. But when you get I don't need any more of it.
Thank you.
But when you get down to it, Christianity is a risk. And we got a lot of people who want to play safe with their faith. And Jesus would come back and say, when I'm asking you to give everything and give your life to me, I've already given mine for you. I'm asking you to give your life in service back. That's risky. And if you think about the Stephens and the Pauls and the Peters of the New Testament, you realize they didn't get the memo when it came to safety. They said, we'll give it all. And one of my beliefs is that we have under-challenged teenagers. We have not over-challenged them. And they respond much better to the challenge, to the adventure, even sometimes the danger of it. I've taken kids down to the inner cities of Houston and Denver, Colorado, and various places that I was personally a little scared, and I could not guarantee we're not going to have a situation that's going to be a little scary. But you know what? I took more kids on those mission trips than I ever took to Six Flags. I could pack them in going on a mission trip because they said, there's no telling what's going to happen. I'd say, yeah, I know. Now, we took our precautions just like anybody else, but I could not guarantee everybody's going to be safe. And they ran into people that asked them hard questions about Jesus, and they had to answer them. They'd come back and say, what do we think about that? And I'd say, I don't know. What do you think about that? And they had to dig it out themselves and look inside at the Gospels of Jesus and say, how would he treat that question? All these things are important because I guarantee you at some point this world is going to be a risky place. I don't know if you can see the mouse that's inside the cage. When we talk about letting them out in the real world, he's saying, I'd rather not. I'd rather stay inside. And I guarantee you, if you've been around teenagers very long, you know that teenagers are going to do some pretty dumb things such as this. Licking a pig's nose. And you're going, see there? They licked that. Well, how do you think that they learn? They learn from bad experiences. That's how you know you've had an experience. You've had a bad one. And you go, I'm not doing that again. Well, sometimes those experiences are spiritual experiences. I have several kids. I've got some that will listen to me carefully, and they'll learn from my big, big, bad mistakes. And I got other kid or two that goes, I'm going to have to go try that. And they'll come back and say, you're right. That's a bad idea. And I go, why didn't you listen? Didn't believe you. Do you believe me now? Yes. I wish I could train them. And I wish they'd listen to me, but it doesn't always work that way. And we have a generation that's going to be pushing some of those edges. Second thing, I think it's really significant, and one of those things I got to tell you, is most leaderships, when you sit down and talk, and I've talked to a lot of search committees through the years about ministers, and when they talk about their youth ministry, I hear them say, we want someone who's going to take care of our kids. And here's the sad part. I want to ask the question, what about the kids who are not there already? When are we going to have a youth ministry that says, the kids who are not here should be a priority, and we're going to go get them? And a mission of our youth ministries to say, we're going to go get some kids who are not going to know about Jesus unless we go get them. They don't have great parents. They got some pretty lousy parents, as a matter of fact. Sometimes, some of them are great, but some of them are lousy. And they flat need the gospel. And they need a church body and a community that's going to bring them in and make a family. It's going to adopt them, which is so biblical. Adopt them in. This is a problem, because when we start saying it's all about our kids, then who decides that writes our paycheck becomes paramount. If I'm not making all my constituents very happy here within these walls, then I am missing the boat, and I could have my job in jeopardy. Going to a deeper place and asking clarity questions about what is our youth ministry going to be built on. Are we going to go out? Are we going to teach our kids to go out and share their faith? Or are we going to just, once again, play safe and play this protected in this little protected bubble? Here's the last one that's a little more personal. with, well, let me tell you about the teamwork deal. That's us against parents. If parents are going one way, we're going the other. About the safety deal, that's what we wind up with. And we don't get very far very fast. And the last one on this one is we expect a lot out of our youth ministers. I've been doing this deal a long time. When I first started youth ministry, all you had to do is, you know, have a couple of idea books, a couple of Devo talks, and you were good to go. That's all I expected. Just keep those kids out of jail and out of trouble, and we're okay. Now, what churches expect out of youth ministers is phenomenal. That you need a second degree, a double major in psychology, maybe in sociology, plus your ministry skills, because you're dealing with kids who are dealing with a variety of things, everything from cutting. They're dealing with suicide. They're dealing with eating issues and disorders. You've got to figure out how to deal with divorced families, single parenting, blended families. All that becomes your issue. And they expect you to know a lot about those things. And to plan your calendar, because you know some of those kids from single parent homes, and they're with dad every other weekend and mom every other. And if you put certain things on certain dates, that kid may never be a part of your youth group experience. Those things become difficult things. And so we have set a very high bar for our youth ministers. And I want you to understand and know as churches that this is tough. And realize we're talking about typically the youngest minister on staff is the youth minister many times. And we expect them to know all this stuff and know how to deal with all this stuff. And the really difficult part is they're all supposed to keep about 4 to 5 different generations happy at the same time. Everybody's got to be happy. You know, the preacher, he doesn't have to connect with the teenagers or the small children. You don't think that's a big deal. Youth minister, you better. And you still better make the old people happy. And you better make the elders happy. And those old boomers that are out there messing things up, you know, the greatest generation of all time, thank you very much. Who think that? It's a tough gig. It's a tough job. So, we've got to do a better job at being realistic with them and helping them along the way. I got to tell you about a kid. This is a kid named Glenn. Glenn was in my youth group. He's a great illustration of everything I'm talking about. He was the kid, loud, obnoxious, drove too fast in his truck. He'd come peeling out of the church parking lot when church was over or when he was coming in. Everybody knew, you know, the young parents, they grabbed their young children when Glenn came in the parking lot. Glenn was the one, he's that one kid that you just go, he's on my nerves at all times. And Glenn was always at every single youth event, constantly. He never missed. And there were nights, I have to tell you, I prayed he would miss. You know what I mean? He was that kid. And you're just going, Lord, you know, you said you wouldn't tempt me beyond what I could bear. Take him out, you know, of my life. Please, take him out. And he's the type of kid who we'd be on a trip or a retreat or whatever, and somebody would get hurt. It was never Glenn. Never once was Glenn hurt. Those closest around Glenn were hurt because Glenn had swung a pillow and hit their head into that sharp corner. So I would take that kid to the hospital for stitches because of Glenn. And I wish I could say it was just one student, one incident. No. Several students through the years. And every time I didn't have to ask any questions. Oh yes, it was Glenn. He would do the dumbest things you could imagine. We were driving down the Houston Highway, 55 miles an hour. Glenn takes a young woman's little stuffed animal, sticked it in the window of those windows that close down, and they're about this long on a van, and he's squeezing that stuffed animal on its neck to make the girl scream, and it was succeeding. She was screaming like crazy. That's my, you know, Fifi or what, you know, Bambi or whatever. And he's squeezing that window down on that animal, and one of the sponsors was saying, no, 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 no. And sure enough, he pushed it all the way to the bottom, and that whole window going at 55 miles an hour shatters. And it shatters inward because we were doing 55 miles an hour. Imagine 100,000 pieces of tiny glass have just been sprayed in the face of your whole youth group in that building. And they called me and said, hey, we've had a problem. And I said, what? And they said, a window shattered. And I said, could Glenn be a part of this? Yes. He is the guy. And I was furious and mad. Went back to the van, opened the doors, and everyone in the van is like this. They're all sitting there. And everybody's eyes are closed because there's glass all over their faces, in their eyes. It's all over. And we sat there by that road of Houston, picking glass out of people's eyes and clothes and hair for an hour. And the whole time I'm saying, why me, Lord? He could have been in any youth group in America. But I walked with him, talked to him, took him to those inner cities of Houston and Denver, took him to those places, and God got a hold of him. Now, he didn't make Glenn better right away, but he got a hold of him. And I walked with his parents, and his parents said, man, I appreciate you putting up. You know, I know he's a handful. He's a handful here at the house, but man, you're doing some good stuff, you know, and I appreciate you pushing him and challenging him and his faith. And as we continued on, there were several other men in our church. They're great volunteers that did the same thing with Glenn. It wasn't just me, a lot of people. But his mother sent me a picture, and the picture that she sent me was this one that you see maybe in your packet. That's Glenn's first job. He's a cop. A Dallas police officer. Glenn. Glenn. You understand this? Glenn. They gave Glenn a gun. A big stinking gun. And I looked at that and I went, what were they thinking? Is there no filter on the process? And then I realized, it's a perfect job. It's the perfect job for Glenn. One, he always loved to drive fast. He can do it legally now. He's in. Two, Glenn never got hurt himself. But the bad guys in Dallas, they're about to get a lesson. He's going to hurt them. And he's going to hurt them really sometimes. But he's just the perfect guy to make that happen. So his mama said, look what Jesus did. Look what Jesus did. And Glenn brings me his phone every once in a while, and he'll start throwing these pictures by. And he said, well, this was a murder. You know, I was working that case, and here's some kids that lost their dad, you know, in a gang-related deal. And he said, my youth group's not like yours, Robert. And I said, how's it different? He said, mine's a little bit rough. I said, you don't understand my life, man. You were really rough on me. He said, well, but look. And he said, these kids are all crying. He said, I took them, told them we're going to be all right. And I've helped them, and we're going to help them, and we're going to be there for them long term. And as I saw, once again, Glenn, who I thought, the Lord cannot use this guy. There's no possible way the Lord got a hold of him. And I would tell you, most youth ministers, and I have to tell you, there were moments where I was going, not sure I can do this. Lord teaches us what he can do with some of the folks like Glenn. And the tough things that go on in our youth ministries are hard. It's a risky deal. There's going to be some times where you're going to take some beatings. for who you take. I took a bunch of boys on a mission trip one time that had been stealing beer from a local place distributor here in town, jumping over the fence, stealing it, going over the fence, and then going and drinking it. Not only drinking it, but inviting other youth group members to come and drink it with them. Caught wind of that and said, I think we're going to have to stop that. And we had a little talk and come to Jesus meeting about those, but came time to decide, am I going to take these boys on a mission trip or not? And I decided to take the risk. After all, I thought, who needs a mission trip more than these guys? And they went with me. And they became some of the greatest leaders in their churches that I could even imagine. All of them were youth volunteers, became youth deacons in the church. And I thought, the Lord has paid them back for all the grief they have given me. What Dave and I want you to know is it's time to ask hard questions. Be clear about what a mission is. Don't give in to the anxiety. Don't give in to the pressure of got to keep things just safe and put these little boys and girls in bubble wrap so they won't get hurt. It's to experience the mission of God. And if we present it, I think as Jesus presents it, I think they'll respond to the call. No, we're almost out of time. One or two questions from anything we said. David, hop on up here just in case. Here they want anything, clarification? Anything we said today? You're ready, get out of here. All right, that's good. Thank y'all for being with us.
Thank you.
Okay, it's all yours. Good job.
Hey, thank you.